This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
United States flies its strategic bombers and stealth fighters to South Korea following the North's latest ballistic missile tests. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the situation is very difficult in the Donbass and other Russian annexed regions, urging intensified security work to protect residents there. Also ahead, 100,000 UK nurses on strike amid a deadlock with the government over wage levels. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, tensions remain high on the Korean Peninsula. The United States has reportedly deployed B-52 bombers and F-22 fighters for joint drills with South Korea. The deployments are the first since May 2018. They come days after Pyongyang launched two mid-range ballistic missiles. North Korea says its recent slew of missile tests are a response to the growing presence of the U.S. in the region and its joint military drills with South Korea and Japan. Meanwhile, North Korea has denounced Japan's new security strategy after it unveiled its biggest military buildup since World War II. Pyongyang says Tokyo's talk of the right to preemptive strikes represents a new aggression policy and North Korea's warning of practical countermeasures. Our correspondent Frank Smith earlier joined us from Seoul. He says the deployment of U.S. bombers is rooted in South Korea's attempt to bring more strategic weapons to the region.
This follows South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's determination to bring more so-called strategic assets. Those are American weapons that can potentially deliver nuclear weapons. This also comes with a stronger commitment to so-called extended deterrence. That's the U.S. nuclear umbrella, in which the U.S. promises essentially to use any weapons at its disposal, including nuclear weapons, to defend its allies around the world, and in this case, South Korea and Japan. Unfortunately, what we really have here is an arms race now developing, with Korea spending more money on weapons, generally U.S. weapons. Japan just announcing that it's going to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP, including developing counter-strike capabilities to respond to what it perceives as a North Korean threat.
The Russian president says the situation in four Ukrainian regions Russia has annexed is extremely difficult. Vladimir Putin ordered security services to ensure the safety of people living in those areas. He also instructed the agencies to step up surveillance to protect borders of the region and combat new threats. Putin's comments come as Ukraine renewed calls for more weapons amid strikes against its energy infrastructure and allegations that Belarus could join Russia in the war. Both Belarus and Russia have denied the allegations. Moscow also says the attacks on Ukraine's energy facilities are a response to the country's strikes on Russian power lines. EU member states have finally reached a deal on setting a price cap on natural gas in a bid to tackle the energy crunch triggered by the war in Ukraine. A spokesperson for the Czech Republic, which holds the rotating presidency of the bloc, said the energy ministers have finalized a price limit of 180 euros per megawatt hour. The deal follows weeks of talks on the emergency measure that had split opinions across the 27 member bloc. It includes a package of measures to help the members protect their citizens and businesses from extreme price volatility, that is, and prepare for the next winter. The Polish Prime Minister says the new compromise will put an end to what he called the Russian manipulation of the market. Moscow, however, has described the move as, quote, unacceptable, saying the cap is an attack on market pricing. The price cap will come into effect on February 15th. UK nurses go on strike today in their second industrial action in less than a week over the economic hardships they're facing. Up to 100,000 nurses walk out from their jobs in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. They want better pay rises to be able to cope with soaring inflation. And that's after the government offered raises of roughly 4 to 5%. The striking nurses are just a fraction of public and private sector workers taking industrial action over pay and working conditions. Ambulance workers, including paramedics and call handlers, are set to strike on Wednesday. Britons are grappling with a cost of living crisis worsened by decades-long high inflation. The stakes are rising in a U.S. congressional investigation of Donald Trump. In a historic move, the panel probing last year's assault on the Capitol has recommended that criminal charges be filed against the former president.
The question is on the motion to favorably report to the House. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. In the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it.
The Democratic-led House of Representatives Committee voted unanimously to refer the charges to the Justice Department. The charges include inciting an insurrection, obstruction of an official proceeding, conspiring to defraud the U.S. government, and making false statements. Congress had never made a criminal referral against a sitting or former president. The charges could result in a ban from public office for Trump and even prison time. He says the recommendation of the, quote, fake charges against him is part of an attempt to prevent him from running for the White House again. At least five people died in the Capitol riot on January 6, 2021. The mob storming the Congress building sought to prevent the transfer to President Joe Biden amid claims by Trump and many of his supporters that the election was rigged and stolen. The Israeli regime has launched a missile attack on the Syrian capital, Damascus, in a new act of aggression against the Arab country. Military sources say Syrian air defenses shot down most of the Israeli missiles. The sources added that the attack resulted in the injury of two soldiers but caused no loss of life. The missiles were fired from the northeast of Lake Tiberias in the occupied territories in the early hours of Tuesday. Israel has frequently launches missile attacks on Syria, and Damascus has repeatedly complained to the UN over the Israeli violation of its sovereignty and territorial integrity, urging the Security Council to take action. The calls have, however, fallen on deaf ears. Medical negligence in Israeli jails has taken the life of another Palestinian inmate. A general strike has now been announced in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah to mourn the death of Nasser Abu Hamid. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says the Palestinian prisoner was suffering from serious health conditions before he lost his life.
We are speaking about Nasser Ahmed, this Palestinian prisoner and the leader of the Fatah's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah. He was arrested by the Israeli forces in 2010, and he received five life sentences behind bars, plus 50 years as well. He was arrested by the Israeli forces several times before 2002. The Israelis had accused Nasser Abu Ahmed of killing a number of Israeli soldiers during the incursions that taken place in Ramallah. What happened is that Nasser Abu Ahmed was diagnosed as a cancer-stricken prisoner, and the Israeli prison authorities had refused to release him upon calls by the by his family and his mother, as well as by the Palestinian Authority and the different resistance groups. Instead, and according to doctors, the result of the tumor in his head was a direct result that the Israeli jailers or the Israeli authorities were not giving Nasser Abu Hamed the appropriate medication.
Meanwhile, Israeli soldiers and settlers have been stepping up their attacks against Palestinian civilians in the occupied West Bank and other areas. Lately, two Palestinian brothers have become the latest victims of Israeli settlers' crimes. A settler deliberately ran over them with his car in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus and fled the scene. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has accused the Israeli regime of letting the perpetrators get away with such crimes to further incite such violence against Palestinians.
An Israeli settler has run over two Palestinian brothers near the city of Nablus in the north of the occupied West Bank, making them the latest victims of Israeli settler crimes. According to Palestinian media, Mohammad Mutair and his brother Mohammed had stopped their vehicle by the side of the road near the Zatara military checkpoint south of Nablus to fix a flat tire. It was then that an Israeli settler hit the siblings, who were traveling around with their family members at the time, and fled the scene. The victim's relatives said that 28-year-old Mohammed was killed immediately after being trampled on by the settler, while his brother, 24-year-old Mohammed, was seriously injured in the same accident and was later announced dead due to his injuries. Reacting to the atrocity, Hazem Qasem, a spokesman for the Gaza Strip-based Hamas Palestinian Resistance Movement, said the settlers are escalating their aggression against Palestinians. He added that the formation of the new right-wing government in Israel has apparently emboldened settlers to ratchet up their crimes against Palestinians. He described the incident as a new episode in the series of, quote, Zionist terrorism under the protection of the regime's police and army, saying this crime must be answered by increasing the resistance in the West Bank. Israeli occupation soldiers and settlers have been noticeably escalating their attacks against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank and other areas, in an attempt to forcibly expel Palestinians from their lands and make way for expanding Israeli settlements. Israeli forces have also been conducting overnight raids and killings in the northern occupied West Bank, mainly in the cities of Jenin and Nablus, where new groups of Palestinian resistance fighters have been formed. Since the start of 2022, Israeli troops have killed more than 210 Palestinians, including more than 50 children, in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. Earlier, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs described 2022 as the deadliest year for Palestinians since 2005, when the UN started to keep a tally of Palestinian fatalities. The world body says Israeli forces have shot dead 19 Palestinians, including 3 children, in different incidents across the occupied territories between November 22nd and December 11th. In addition to the killings, Israeli forces have blocked the main entrances of several villages across the West Bank, disrupting livelihoods of thousands of Palestinians.
In yet another provocative move against Palestinian worshippers this time, scores of Israeli settlers have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds. This is Islam's third holiest site, under the pretext of celebrating the Jewish festival of Hanukkah. On their part, the Palestinian forces, factions, and commissions have called for the defense of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Yeah. Scores of Israeli settlers, guarded by police, have stormed the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds under the pretext of celebrating Hanukkah holiday. Earlier, the Israeli police stormed Al-Aqsa and forcibly expelled Palestinians stationed inside, paving the way for the illegal settlers to storm the compound. Israeli forces deployed heavily inside Al-Quds Old City in preparation for securing the settlers' incursions and preventing Palestinians from entering the mosque. Israeli settlers intend to storm Al-Aqsa for 8 days to celebrate the so-called Hanukkah, also known as Festival of Lights, which extends from December 18th to December 26th, as settler groups promoted the storming by announcing free transportation for its members. Israeli groups and extremist settlers had previously called for massive incursions into the holy site during the Hanukkah holidays. Hardline Israeli officials and settlers regularly stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied city, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. Settlers' incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque frequently trigger clashes that leave casualties among Palestinians. Such acts of violence even led to an 11-day war between Palestinian resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip and the Israeli regime in 2021, during which the regime forces killed at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the latest raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli settlers. Hamas says such incursions are provocative and very dangerous. The movement has urged Palestinians to mobilize immediately in defense of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The resistance movement stressed the Palestinian nation will make sure to protect the mosque under any circumstances, warning Israel of the consequences of raids on the holy site. The Jewish visitation of Al-Aqsa is permitted, but as part of a decades-old agreement between Jordan, the custodian of Islamic and Christian sites in Al-Quds, and Israel in the wake of Israel's occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967, non-Muslim worship at the compound is prohibited.
Elsewhere, Iran is calling on the U.S. to choose diplomacy over pressure, intimidation, and confrontation if it really wants the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Iran's permanent ambassador to the U.N. says the U.S. must show real political will and agree to completely fulfill its obligations under the agreement. Emir Saeed Iravani emphasized Iran's commitment to dialogue and diplomacy. He said Iran is ready to resume the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA and even arrange a ministerial meeting as soon as possible to declare its restoration. The Iranian official stressed that the current standoff is a direct result of the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the deal in 2018. That brings an end to our World Bulletin. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini left Tehran for the holy city of Qom 3 weeks after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. He stayed in Qom nearly for 10 months. During this period, people would come to visit the Imam from all over the country. However, the great leader of the Islamic Revolution had to return to Tehran due to heart problem. Today, we will continue the story. Stay tuned, please. As it was said before, Imam Khomeini had to go up the steps to the roof of his house in Qom as people would gather in the alley to visit him. The Imam used to do this several times every day. Thus, he would get tired and his heart would be under pressure. Moreover, Imam Khomeini would receive a number of officials every day. This magnitude of work soon caused him heart problem in early 1980. One day his wife, Ms. Saghafi, noticed the severe pain in the Imam's shoulder and left hand, so she soon informed Haj Ahmad of the event. The Imam's special physician, Dr. Baher, asked for checking up his heart by a heart specialist. Ms. Faride Mustafavi, the Imam's daughter, relates the story. Dr. Baher came to visit the Imam. After checking him, he said that the Imam's heart should be checked up by a specialist. Then he immediately telephoned Tehran and a medical team was sent to Qom. When I went to the Imam's residence, I saw that Dr. Zargar, then Minister of Health, was there with a few people. Medical checkup was done and the physicians came to the conclusion that the Imam should be checked up for a few days. Therefore, the next day, the Imam was sent to Tehran in an ambulance and was hospitalized at Tehran's Heart Hospital. The day after, my mother came to Tehran and went to his father's house. Then he went to the Imam at the hospital. The news of Imam Khomeini's hospitalization spread across the country in a few minutes. Thus, a big crowd of people gathered in the streets around the hospital. The medical team asked the people to pray for the Imam's health and immediate healing. People gradually left the area as they had become sure of his health. But the enemies spread rumors on Imam Khomeini's demise or his suffering from an incurable disease. Meanwhile, in spite of the physician's recommendation on absolute resting, the Imam delivered a very short speech, which was televised and broadcast on TV. This short speech ended all rumors of enemies. Fortunately, Imam Khomeini gained his health with the efforts of doctors and the prayers of people and left the hospital. The medical team said that the Imam should reside near the Heart Hospital to be under surveillance. Imam Khomeini accepted the recommendation, although he liked to return to Qom. Therefore, a house was determined in Darabad neighborhood of Tehran, but due to people's frequent commutation and the medical team's presence, there were disturbances for inhabitants of the place. Thus, another place was proposed for the Imam's residence. Haj Ahmad and the daughters of Imam Khomeini saw the house and accepted it as it was adjacent to a Hosseiniye, which was a suitable place for public meetings. The Hosseiniye was called Hosseiniye Jamaran. A few days later, the household furniture was transferred to the new house. Hosseiniye Jamaran was half built and it was full of construction materials, but it was completed with the people's effort within 4 days. In mid-May 1980, people decorated the street to welcome the Imam. Imam Khomeini came at 7 p.m., while a big number of people had gathered there. After entering the house and looking at the rooms, the Imam said, "Now I am comfortable, as I was under pressure for 4 months." The new house was small, but the Imam liked it. At 8 o'clock, the Imam said that he was ready to meet the people around the house. Therefore, the first public meeting was held at Hosseiniye Jamaran. A few days later, the VOA said that after a few months of searching, a place had been determined for Ayatollah Khomeini, which is immune against any air raid. The next examinations revealed that the Imam's residence was suitable in terms of security, as it was beside mountains and surrounded among tall trees. Although the Imam's wife would complain about the size of the rooms, the Imam told her, "This is a good house. Those who come here will know that this is your house."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Capital Tehran has been host to a forum called the Tehran Dialogue Forum. It's themed to push regional friendship, attended by nearly 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries. The focus was on the policy of the Islamic Republic towards its neighbors and its approach to friendship and trust building. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at Iran's policy initiatives and how the region and the world can actually benefit from the enhanced relations between Iran and its neighbors, minus the presence of the U.S. in the West Asia region, and without Israeli interference.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adil Abdul Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We can only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014. And we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020. And as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yusumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
Time to introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mohammad Ali Araki joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from London. Also joining us, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who also joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Saeed Mohsin Abbas, I will start with you and ask you about the necessity for this Tehran Dialogue Forum in the first place. Taking a look at the platform in terms of what it says, I'm going to put it in a short format so you can elaborate more for us. Platform of interaction and communications among political officials and thinkers, which focuses on the West Asia region in particular. Do you think that this is a forum that is necessary, of course, with Iran being the host?
I think it's one of the most necessary initiatives for that West Asian region that there could possibly be, because, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been an advocate of peace and regional security since the revolution, without a doubt. I mean, just some examples to show the history of Iran's engagement, this persistent history of trying to create peace in that region. The Hormuz Peace Plan, which was an initiative of the previous government, Iran, which aimed at establishing security, you know, in the region, including the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Sea of Oman. And that initiative was planned to be with the participation of all countries of that region. And that's been really the foreign policy stance of the Islamic Republic. That's the default one. The trouble is that the presence of Israel and the foreign presence of America, because of course it's not part of West Asia. It's a perennial interference in that region, and its manipulation of some of the people within that region and some of the leaders particularly has led to essentially nothing but war, conflict, and plunder and pillaging. This is just on record. We only need to look at the record they have in terms of what they're doing in Palestine as far as Israel's concerned, what they did in Syria, what they've done in Iraq. All of these initiatives, which were a partnership of the Anglo-Zionist Empire, have led to nothing but instability in the region. Iran has always advocated the opposite. In fact, they could argue that it's because of the Islamic Republic of Iran that a lot of these fires that could have turned into the huge destruction in that region have changed into far more settled, or at least on the way to settling disputes and conflicts. You know, Iraq is one example. Iran's influence there has led to less sectarian confrontation. It's led to the destruction of ISIS, which would have been a nightmare for everybody. Sure. In Syria, we've seen that the sovereignty of Syria was ultimately maintained to the best of the ability, and that was largely due to Iranian backup, I would say. And of course, we can see also for the rights of those oppressed in the region, where of course you can't have peace without justice. And I think Iran has stuck to that mantra as well, and that policy of saying, look, we need justice in this area, and for that, we need to all settle our issues in the West Asian region if we happen to be living here, not allow foreign powers, superpowers, to come in and dictate their agendas, which are usually based on their self-interest, economic interest, and, might I add, the destruction of Iran primarily, and any other Arab or Muslim nation in that region that wants independence.
Sure. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned this Hormuz peace endeavor, of which Muhammad Ali Araki, I'm going to ask you, this was something that was introduced by the former Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. And it was years ago that he presented that. Actually, he went to the UN with it and talked about how this initiative to bring peace and stability, especially in the Strait of Hormuz and the Sea of Oman, is key. But he underlined that this can only be achieved through cooperation and dialogue without foreign interference, and that the regional countries must decide that on their own. Again, this would be in reference to only the two that Sayyid Mohsen Abbas mentioned, which first and foremost would be the U.S., and maybe along with that, Israel. Years ago, why didn't that have the momentum required? Because we are still experiencing this foreign interference in the form of the U.S. in the region.
Yes, so the interference of the United States of America alongside the apartheid Zionist regime of Israel has been in the region in the past few years, but we have witnessed that, especially since the presence of President Ayatollah Raisi in the Islamic Republic of Iran. He has taken the path down a state of resolving things. We have witnessed a far more diplomatic activity by his government to resolve the problems and end the foreign interference. I personally believe that the meeting that will be happening soon has a big influence in the peace that will come into the region, because the neighboring
countries... I'm sorry, can you tell us which meeting you were referring to? I didn't catch that.
Yes?
Which meeting are you referring to, the upcoming meeting you just stated? I didn't catch whom you were referring to.
By the meeting that will be by the Persian Gulf countries, they'll be coming, and Mr. Amir Abdullahian, he spoke about it today. There'll be a summit, and based on what I read, it will be taking place in Iran. Now, I believe that the neighboring countries of the Islamic Republic of Iran, especially the Persian Gulf countries, will reach the conclusion that Iran is a true friend for the days of hardship and the good days, and they'll realize, and we can see the change, that the apartheid regime of Israel and its allies are not that true good friend that has always been portrayed on the media. And we have had the different leaders of resistance focus on the fact that, and refer to it, that this normalization of the ties between Israel and many Islamic countries, it's not going to last. I believe this meeting will be a turning point, and it will be a start for the situation changing, and we will be having more peace, hopefully, in the region. And as a result of that, the United States of America and its allies will have to pack up their suitcases and leave the region.
Sure. Well, you know, when you talk about the so-called normalization, say, Mohsen Abbas, what's key here, and it hasn't really been answered, and maybe you can help us in explaining this to us, is that one of the angles behind and the initiative behind this was to have Israel establish the so-called normalization, try to get these Persian Gulf Arab countries to entertain that, so that the U.S. wouldn't have to be as actively involved in the region, because then Israel's security would be somewhat established by these, well, whichever countries opted to do so, even though it hasn't really been entertained as much as I think they anticipated. Is that a correct reading into it?
I think we're all aware that the nations that we regard as the Gulf Cooperation Council, for instance, whether it's Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, we can name Saudi Arabia within that as well, the UAE. These forces or these entities have been established by the Anglo-Zionist Empire. They owe their establishment, the leaders owe their positions of power to the Western powers. And ever since their inception, they've been in the pockets of basically the Anglo-Zionist money mafia. And so essentially, they are tied at the hip with those the interests of the West, and they do virtually everything in terms of their foreign policies, and I must say even their domestic and economic policies, which ultimately benefits the West. That doesn't help to really create a genuinely stable, conflict-free West Asia, because of course if you're not interested in your own people's interest in regional trade, in increasing the regional trade, using the energy of the region to help the world, if you're not really interested in having fraternal relationships or even military strategic alliances with your neighbors, that clearly means that you're missing out, for instance, on all sorts of economic benefits that could be there, which go beyond just oil and energy, relying on gas and oil, which is what those Gulf countries are doing. You're also destabilizing the region, and you're spending money on military and weapons, which you probably wouldn't have to. Now, the billions and billions of dollars which these Gulf countries pay to Lockheed Martin and all the sort of licenses for arms and weapons which the Americans and the United Kingdom and other Western countries are lavished with, ultimately benefit the West. They don't benefit these guys. They're sitting there, and every time they run out of these weapons or they get outdated, they go and buy some more. So basically, this relationship of milking the cows of that region has been going on by the West, and Iran is saying, look, you don't need to do this. You can save that money. You can diversify your economy. You can do more trade with your neighbors, especially sure. ourselves. And as a result, there would be prosperity, peace, and automatic sort of harmony in the region. If only they could have the nerve and the courage to step away from their puppet status with Israel, okay. Tel Aviv, with Washington.
Right. Well, that's what I want to ask you, Muhammad Ali Araki, in terms of the most recent visit of the Chinese president to the region, which was to Saudi Arabia. Now, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas talks about countries like Saudi Arabia that are tied to the hip when it comes to the West, in particular the U.S., obviously. But at the same time, we noticed how important now there's been a turn away, as it's been construed, of Saudi Arabia from the U.S., not completely, but we know the dissatisfaction and the tenseness that exists in that relationship. And it seems like well, it doesn't seem like, it's very obvious that Saudi Arabia is turning to China in more ways than one, in particular when it comes to the oil card. Now, in this case in point, are we looking at a shift there, perhaps, of Saudi Arabia away from the U.S., and therefore we have on the other side of this how Iran is close to China also? So therefore, this both spells moves away from the U.S. Can it be construed that way? Something on which obviously we need to expand on more, because Iran's foreign minister talked about China in more ways than one after this visit. But what's your view on that?
Yes. So as I mentioned in the previous question that you asked about the meeting that will occur with the Persian Gulf countries, and that it will result in a shift, I believe that this is also will also result in a shift as well, because the relationship between Saudi Arabia and United States of America has become bitter in the current days, and the meeting of the Chinese official was a very important political message by Saudi Arabia to America and also the allies of China. And yes, we are looking at basically shift of power. And there's also one other thing I must mention, and that is the fact that when this shift occurs, there will also potentially be destabilization in the Persian Gulf countries and Saudi Arabia, because normally the United States of America, when they see that a country is not following their benefits, not in line with them, they would come and cause some so-called organic protests or chaos in the country. But again, the result of this shift, the reason to this shift that has occurred and is on the way of expansion occurring, is because of the fact that the United States of America and its allies are truly not trustworthy friends. Despite, yes, we know that the United States of America has a policy of milking the cow, but this sure. will no longer work.
Okay.
And the reason to that is because they have proven that they're not good friends. They are trustworthy friends to Saudi Arabia, despite we completely disagree with many of the policies that the government of Saudi Arabia is implementing in the region.
Sure. Well, we need to some explanation from you, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, when it comes to Iran vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, in terms of how there are talks that have occurred. Iraq has been the mediator, but we know that hasn't really bore the fruits that perhaps either side wanted. At this point, that door is still open. Even the Iranian foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, at the Tehran Dialogue Forum, has said that we do want to open up our consulates. But at the end of his statement, he said, if Saudi Arabia chooses to take a constructive approach when it comes to Iran, what are we looking at when it comes down to Saudi Arabia and Iran and the region as a whole, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas?
Well, just in the last month, you can see that Saudi Arabia was involved in most of the social media tweeting, which was inciting riots and violence in the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is literally an occurrence that the Saudi regime has been essentially part and parcel of the American color revolution destabilization efforts over the last month or two. We've seen that Saudi Arabia hasn't surrendered its policy in terms of oppressing Yemen, even though it was Iran at the beginning of this year whose initiative basically offered solutions, deal to end blockades in Yemen, to stop the war, and to create some rapprochement and harmony for the Saudis and for the Yemenis to get on with their lives without the kind of mass murders and killings that are going on through Saudi bombing, supplied, of course, by the Anglo-Zionist Empire with their arms as usual. So there are two bits of evidence to say the Saudis have shown no real, sense of change. Okay, yes, we can take it on board that China has a huge, a future impact on that region, what with the Belt and Road Initiative and Iran's tie up with them, Iraq has tied up. The Saudis clearly don't want to be left behind, and there's a lot of jostling going on. The Chinese are playing a very wily diplomatic game as well, and they actually came down literally on the side of the Gulf Arab countries in terms of three islands that belong obviously to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and yet China added its signature to the notion of, considering discussions. I mean, those are territorial issues which the Islamic Republic of Iran will not entertain. And if China did that to sweeten up the Saudis so that they would also buy into the Belt and Road Initiative, that's part of China's, of course, need for access to all of this region. But Iran won't buy into those. And if Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries continue to sort of challenge Iranian sovereignty, if they continue to be involved in color revolutions, if the Saudis continue to help finance ISIS offshoots along with the Americans, if they continue to try and destabilize that region with sectarian narratives, because we know that's been a major tool in trying to keep Iran, if you like, isolated. They've tried to make the Sunni fraternity across the Arab world and beyond actually dislike Iran and not engage with them at all. So these are not portents for a great relationship with Saudi Arabia anytime soon.
Sure. Well, I got, I think, four topics that I know we will not fit in the next few minutes left. So let's see. Let me go with Iraq with you on this, Mohammad Ali Araki, the representative from Iraq at this Tehran Dialogue Forum said that Iraq cannot be used. He said many things which were actually quite incredible. But basically, we're looking at even the current prime minister of Iraq saying that Iraq cannot be used. Many Iraqi administrations have said that Iraq cannot be used as its soil to be used as a launching pad for attacks or any anti-government activities against the Islamic Republic. Tell us why he would say that, who he is referring to. In this case in point, we know that Iraq has talked about, and Iran has actually come out with Iraq against Iraqi Kurdistan and the groups operating out of there, these terrorist groups, they need to put a stop to it. I think they have formed some kind of group that is monitoring those activities. But how important is that? Because that obviously is very important for Iran, and it does contribute to maintaining regional peace and security to stop those anti-Iran activities coming from Iraqi Kurdistan.
So when we're talking about this, we're talking about the national security of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and including the neighbors of the Islamic Republic of Iran, because when the Kurdistan region of Iraq is unsafe and is a safe haven for the Zionists and other terrorists, this will have an impact on Iran and the other neighboring countries. So the Islamic Republic of Iran will not give in. And as we saw in the past few weeks, they did not give in. And they were very serious that if the necessary action was not taken, Iran will do what they see necessary. And so thankfully, what we saw was that Mr. Al-Sudani, after the visit he made to the Islamic Republic of Iran, he took the case seriously, and now we witness that there have been troops deployed by the Iraqi government to enter that border in order to clamp down on any potential threats that will target the Islamic Republic.
Sorry to jump in again for lack of time. I got to give Mohsen Abbas the last question here. On Ukraine, so Mohsen Abbas, Iran has said, we didn't want this war from the beginning. We didn't agree with it, that is. And he said that Iran can even provide means for such a dialogue. Coming from Iran, in terms of this summit, the Tehran Dialogue Forum, and its promotion of peace, tell us your thoughts of Iran on Ukraine war, and how can Iran be construed as a bad actor if it's all about peace? In about 30, 40 seconds.
Well, first of all, Iran was part of a message delivery service, if you like, the foreign minister, to the Russian foreign minister on behalf of a European nation, where they proposed a kind of peace deal around Ukraine, or the beginning of discussion around a peace deal. It was intimated that Macron, Francis Macron, was behind that, but the Iranians participated. If we look at Iran regionally, and this is a summary, really, look, they've tried to help with peace in Afghanistan. They've offered all their services to continue to be a peaceful. They've tried in the Azerbaijani dispute with Armenia, peace brokers, in Yemen, in all of the region that they've tried their utmost.
They must
continue their effort and try their best to push this, even though their enemies going to do their best to break up those efforts.
Sorry, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, fresh out of time. Thank you so much, journalist and political commentator. Mohammad Ali Araki, thank you, journalist and political analyst, both from London. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavle and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have Hujjatul Islam Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Hujjatul Karimi. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
According to a belief in the religion of Islam, the believers cannot be under the dominance of disbelievers and are obliged to resist it. But nowadays in the world, we can see that the dominance, at least at what we look, you know, and what is clear and with it, is in the hands of the arrogant powers and the dominant powers of the world. So how is it that in the riwayas, in the ayahs of the Holy Quran, we have this, we can say, ruling that the believers and the Muslims cannot be under the supremacy of disbelievers, but this is taking place nowadays in the world.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The verse that you refer to is in chapter An-Nisa, chapter 4, verse 141, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, those who lie in wait for you, if there is a victory for you from Allah, they say, were we not with you? But if the faithless get a share of victory, they say, did we not prevail upon you and defend you against the faithful? Allah will judge between you on the day of resurrection. Then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَلَنْ يَجْعَلَ اللَّهُ لِلْكَافِرِينَ عَلَى الْمُؤْمِنِينَ سَبِيلًا And Allah will never provide the faithless, the disbelievers, any way to prevail over the faithful.
That's right.
This verse is known as the ayah of Nafyu Sabil.
Nafyu Sabil, that's
because
right.
Allah has rejected any sabil, any way for the faithless to prevail over the believers,
that's
or
right.
the faithful.
Okay.
There are many discussions about this verse in Islamic jurisprudence. So according to this verse, Muslims are not allowed to accept the supremacy and dominance of the disbelievers.
Disbelievers, that's right.
Now, one part of the question might be that in this verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is talking about himself. لَنْ يَجْعَلَ اللَّهُ لِلْكَافِرِينَ عَلَى الْمُؤْمِنِينَ سَبِيلًا
Yes.
Allah will never provide the faithless any way to prevail over the faithful. But the point is that in practice, as you rightly mentioned, we see that in some parts of the world, at least, the disbelievers have this kind of dominance and way they are prevailing over the believers.
That's right.
So it is as if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has willed something, but another thing has happened. Isn't it against the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Mm-hmm.
Now, to answer this question, we need to know two